This episode is brought to you by Button Down, the easiest way to start, send, and grow your email newsletter.
Hi, welcome to Django Chat, podcast on the Django Web Framework. I'm Will Vincent, joined by Carlton Gibson. Hello, Carlton.
Hello, Will Vincent.
And we're very pleased to welcome back Sheena O'Connell to talk about Django, education, technology, and all those things. Welcome, Sheena.
Hey, thanks. Glad to be back.
Glad to have you, Sheena. Thank you for coming back on.
So last time you were at a startup in Umuzi focused on education and technology, and you since moved on from there, but are still very involved with both education and technology. So maybe I'll let you say, what are you up to these days?
Awesome. Yeah, so Umuzi is more like, it wasn't really a startup. It was a nonprofit in South Africa that finds high potential youth and trains them, and is many wholesome things about that. So over there, I was doing some technology stuff, built a learning platform that worked pretty well and taught a bunch of people stuff, and that was cool. Now I am trying to take everything that I've learned from there, and I'm kind of greenfielding it a little bit and trying to start something new from scratch. And that's terrifying, but also a lot of fun. So I've got two main things that I'm working on. The one is Prelude, which is a training company. So I've already gone through a couple of different iterations of like how to craft this thing and what to focus on. But my main thing at the moment is running workshops that are focused on Python and Django related things. So the most popular one is like how to build a modern front-end using Django. So it's got HTMX and Tailwind and Alpine and Playwright, and just introduces people to all of these things and like how they plug in together and gets them working on it. And that's been pretty cool. People are digging that. And then I've got like another one on Git, because everybody knows somebody who's struggling on Git. everyone. And like a few other things. So that's Prelude. And then, yeah.
Well, I want to jump in. I want to talk about this thing. So, do you want to tell us the other bit first, and then, or should we just jump in? Let's talk about those, because somebody emailed me and was raving about your Django front end workshop.
Oh, thank you.
They were like effusive about how good it was, and so I've heard amazing things. I'm obviously super excited. So you say Django, you say Alpine, you say HTMX, you say Tailwind, you're using Playwright. So this is where the puck is.
Yeah, it's super fun. Like the people who've shown up so far have been like really, really engaged. It's been very, I don't know, like it's quite an intense workshop, because it's like we're covering a lot of stuff and it's over a weekend. So I'm trying to do it over weekends or like not office hours, so that people who are maybe transitioning into tech, they don't necessarily need to quit their day job or take a whole lot of leave to take part. So like there's a lot that happens in a short amount of time and super intense and a lot of interaction with people. And by the end, I'm like a little bit sad, because I'm like, oh, you guys are all leaving. So it's super fun.
So what level do you have? So you say transitioning into tech. So is this assuming no background Python or some?
No, not necessarily. Some background in Python is very helpful. So I have had people show up who haven't used Django before, and they sometimes struggle a little bit because, you know, Django has views and models and URLs and templates, and it's got all this stuff, and they're like, where do I put my code? And so if they're learning Django and all the stuff at the same time, then it can be a bit heavy. Some people can do it. Some people struggle. So I do have a more like basic Django course as well that is like almost a precursor. Like people can do it as a precursor, but it's not as popular, because just learning Django isn't as like fancy.
I just, on that tech stack, that choice of Alpine and HTMX together, I find it really powerful. And really not just powerful, yeah, I find it empowering as an individual developer to be able to do so much. How are your people finding it?
So far they've been finding it pretty good. So part of my thinking on these workshops is you can only do so much in a weekend, but what I can do is I can plant a bunch of seeds and I can set those seeds up to grow a little bit. So after the workshop, I get feedback from people about what they're doing with it, and like during the workshop, they come up with projects that they want to work on, and like most people continue with their projects, which is cool. Sometimes it's work projects, sometimes it's portfolio projects, but they're like leaning into the technologies and actually using them, which is awesome.
I'm a big fan of having having a portfolio, having a little project that you just keep going, keep tweaking, keep playing with. It's a, you know, it's a test.
It's great, like, to get people to go deep into a technology, because a lot of folks who are learning web development get stuck in tutorial hell, and they'll learn a bit of this and they'll learn a bit of that, and they'll always like go down these golden pathways that have been laid out for them, and like real development isn't about following somebody else's golden pathway. You have to get off the beaten track and like build stuff for yourself and bump your head and go deep and get frustrated and overcome the stuff. So like a proper portfolio, it doesn't just demonstrate the technical skills. It shows actually you've got the grit to to do this job, because it takes that. So yeah, big fan of portfolios.
No, and that point about grit, I think, is perfect, because as a prospective employer, you're looking for someone who can solve the problem on, you know, Thursday, and it's turning out difficult. You know, are they able to keep pushing through to the solution? That's super.
Can
I ask about Playwright quickly? I'm not letting you speak for ages.
Okay? No, go.
I'm just too excited. So I've spent ages. I was scarred by Selenium as a young developer, and have battled it for many years. And I've been playing with all sorts of things, Cypress and Jest and Vitesse and all of these other, which aren't really what I need. I need Playwright, but I've been a bit scared. And then Simon Willison said that it's, you know, it really is the thing, and I should give it a go. So can I get, you know, that's almost enough to push me over then. But what's your take on Playwright?
I was also a bit skeptical of it at first, because there are so many different like front-end testing frameworks and tools out there, and there is a bit of fatigue in that space. The thing that actually got me excited about Playwright was a talk I saw at DjangoCon 2023, I think, from, he calls himself the Testing Panda or something like that.
Andy.
And I really enjoyed that talk. Like he broke things down. He was like, here are the pros and cons, and this is why I've chosen this. And I was like, that makes a lot of sense for me. So it's super easy to write Playwright code. It does a lot of, like if you're writing like pure Selenium code, then the code becomes pretty brittle in a lot of ways, really fragile. Because a lot of the time it's just about timing. If you click a button on a website, the reaction to that isn't always immediate, because it'll be fetching data from the back end and doing stuff, and then you end up like having your code littered with all of this like time.sleep what statements, and it just ends up being like hard to see the logic, and it's hard to, and if something just like randomly breaks and you're like, what could it be? Maybe if I make this wait even longer, then it'll work. And you just end up fighting the thing. Playwright has a lot of stuff built in that does that fighting for you, so it'll like check things in a loop and have sensible timeouts and things like that. But it's also really nice because it's got like, it's built for testing, so it's got different assertions and expectations built in, which is great. And probably my favorite thing is it's got a code generator. So remembering how to access every piece of the page through Playwright is kind of a pain in the neck. You don't want to have to like checking the docs all the time is very possible, but it's kind of a pain. So what you can do is you can spin up this thing called CodeGen and point it to a URL, and then you can interact with the web page, and it'll write code to match your interactions, and then you can take that and turn it into a test. And this is super, super cool if you've got like a bug or something in your front end. You can literally go and demonstrate the bug to yourself, and then that'll turn into a test. And then you can just be like, okay, instead of asserting that this thing has a value, assert that it's empty. And then you go and fix your code and the regression doesn't happen. It's fantastic. I like it so much.
That sounds yeah. Like, so you've encouraged me. So between you and Simon, I might pluck up the courage and mark off a day.
Yeah, do it. It's super easy as well. It's very, very easy to get ramped up. The one thing to note is that if you're using it, then you have to use PyTest, Which is fine. Yeah, because it's got all sorts of PyTest tooling, but it doesn't have the same for unit test, and you'd have to jump through some hoops to make it work nicely.
Okay, well, we can perhaps cope with that. Before I let Will speak again, I want to ask you about your Git course, because I kind of feel that Git is sort of developer literacy, basic.
Yes.
It's essential.
Yeah, it is. It really is. So I created it because I saw a need. Like, a lot of people, when they're learning to code, they just learn some basic commands and they're like, this sort of seems to push the code over there, or they drag and drop to upload their stuff into GitHub. That also happens a lot. And it's not like a fun, fashionable skill. It's just this weird chore that people have to do. So they're not excited about learning it. And then on top of that, like, so when I ran my Django modern front-end course, like, I pay attention to what people are struggling with and what they need, and Git came up as a thing that a couple of people were struggling with. It was like, okay, cool, we actually need a course on this, they need to focus on this, and there's a bit to it. And I've also spent time just talking to people who work for like consultancies and whatnot. And I was chatting to a friend of mine recently, for example, and he was ranting about how his coworkers are still naming things like version 1, version 2. And so, like, even people who, like, are not beginners are still struggling with Git. And it's like, Git is weird, but it's not actually that hard. Like, it's hard until you, like, grasp what the graph is doing, like what the commit graph is doing and what the different commands do to the Git graph. And then once you know the graph and you know how to, like, look at it and interrogate it, then you're like, oh, actually this is fairly straightforward for the most part. So yeah, so that was the thinking behind it. And so this course that I've made, it's just one day long. And it's still, like, quite a long day, but it covers, again, like, understanding the commit graph, like, how to commit things, how merging and branching work, dealing with remotes, dealing with merge conflicts, because that always, like, breaks people's heads the first time. Well, and then you're like...
Yeah. That's when you delete your Git repo and reclone it, right, at that point.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of that. I did that once when I was a young group.
It's a total fail safe. Yes.
Rebase, yeah. Too, right? I feel like rebase is one of those ones. Like, you feel like you're comfortable, and then someone's like, what about rebase? And there is a little... What is your take, right? Isn't there still some argument on what, you know, how much you should use rebase or not?
Yeah, so I would go with whatever, like, the team is using already most of the time. I like rebase because you do get that linear history, but sometimes if you rebase a thing, like, you just end up having to deal with lots of merge conflicts, like, in a row. Like, another one. And it ends up being, like, a lot of work and confusion just to have, like, a tidy-looking branch structure. And so I'm not... Like, I'm a fan of it when it's clean and when it just works. But when you have to, like, really hit it with a hammer to make it work, then I'm like, well, I don't know if it's really adding that much benefit. Yeah.
I think when you've got a contributor who perhaps doesn't know how to do it, sometimes it's easier just to say, no, you just keep pushing commits and we'll sort this out at the end for the way we want, rather than somebody who hasn't got the skills and then saying, oh, and can you learn Git rebases? Oh, no, let's not do that.
Yeah, you don't want to give people extra stumbling blocks if you're trying to get some good out of them and just be like, here, do this really frustrating thing. That's
the price of entry here.
Yes, show us your grit.
It's a tough thing because you kind of have to be doing it live or on a real thing to really focus on it, right? And so by nature, you're going to be... I don't know how your workshop is done. Like, you almost need like a Git games. Like, they used to have those this kind of like capture the flag for like security things, right? I think there are things like this for Git, but generally you're like, oh, dang, I need to like put this code somewhere. And then, you're doing it on the fly. And at the same time, you're dealing with, you know, a Django fellow who lives in Git. And who is like, So I always think of that with production too. Production is hard to teach people because you can, okay, local Django, but then production, just like this whole world of like, it's so different. And then it's live, so you don't necessarily want to mess it up.
And then, too hard, yeah.
And then if you've ever, like, you know, if you mention staging servers to newcomers, their head is just like, they're like, I quit. Like, I can't even wrap my head around, you know, like my local database, my production database, wait, they're different. Like, yeah. And then you say staging, it just like blows their head.
Yeah, it's tricky. It's like, so you always want to build up to things over time, I find. So even with the front end course, like give a person a thing to learn and let them practice that, then give them like a slightly harder thing or like a slightly different thing, and try to keep them like in the zone of proximal development. So you try and keep the, like, if it's too easy, it's boring. If it's too hard, then they're just like, well, I'm stepping away. And yeah, keeping it in that zone is a little bit of an art form, but it can be done, but it takes some iteration. Yeah.
And is also, there's that disconnect between what an individual or a small team does and what a big team does. And most of the people who have the time or take the time to write, right, they say, this is how my team does it. You know, because I run sites that collect money. I don't have a staging server. you know, I'm not even using Docker for it anymore, you know, but if I had a bunch of, so it's both the combination of what is out there, right? Like, oh, you need interactive jump to React. You know, that was the thing back in the day.
Yeah.
But then also, if you're doing it your own way, do you write it up? And maybe there's even more variety, right? Like, I know Carlton and I do our stuff very differently.
I'm just doing it how I used to do it 20 years ago, and I've just kept doing it exactly the same way.
I'm that just a little bit newer, but I'm still probably old with, you know, I can see, especially in a workshop, when someone has one of these things, they can, you know, raise their hand or whatever, and you can help them get past this thing of like, oh, do I focus on this? Do I not focus on this? Okay, I'm stuck. Because so much of it is, I think, to get out of the tutorial thing is asking for help and doing it in a way that, like, you know, if you have to ask to a forum, like the Django forum, right? People ask questions there. They should use it. It's great. But you don't always get a great response because you have to ask a good question. And also, if you have to wait a day or two or three, you're kind of right out of the...
Yeah, you get blocked. Yeah.
Whereas if you're actually in a workshop with someone who can
help you immediately. Yeah.
Yeah. Then you can keep the momentum going, I think, a lot more.
Yeah, I think that's very powerful. That's one of the pieces of feedback that I got, is like the human interaction is the thing that... Like, the content is solid, the skills that they're learning are solid, but the human interaction makes it a bit more like this magical experience.
And for you too, right? To think to think about the things you already know that we don't think about, right? I mean, that's the curse of experiences. We're just dealing with our own problems, and you just completely take for granted. Even I do this, and even though I email with readers and stuff, there's still things I'm like, oh, is that hard? Is that complicated? Like, because I've just done it so many times now. So I need those reminders.
Yeah, I get you. Like, it's so surprising sometimes, some of the things that people get confused about. I'll give you some examples. Like, so I had a workshop where one of the people was really like putting files in weird places. Like, if there was an instruction to put this in the root directory, it was like almost random where it ended up. And then it turned out they needed to know what the root directory was. And like, so when I noticed, I tried to explain it once, and I'm like, okay, that didn't land. So the other thing that's kind of cool is sometimes a person will try to help a person once, and then they'll be like, I've done my job, and they'll like go off and do something else. But in a teaching situation, it's almost like it's a challenge for the teacher to be like, how do I make this land? Oh, I tried to explain it this way and it didn't. Let me try again. And then they got it, and life was good. And they were very, very happy that now they have this concept that has been bugging them since they started to learn to code. And another one that happened, so I ran that workshop again last weekend, and there was one guy who was like, let me tell you what I want to see from HTMX. I was like, cool, tell me, I want to see. And he brings up his VS Code, and he's like, there's this cool thing that React does, let me show you. He brings up his VS Code, he opens a React project, and he's got Tailwind installed in his React project, and he starts like writing out Tailwind classes, and it auto-completes. He's like, this is something React does. I want HTMX to do that. It's like, okay, we're going to have to dig deep now.
It's all magic. It's all magic. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like very surprising sometimes what people bring, what people like conflate.
Yeah. Well, I'll let Carl, sorry, Carlton, I'll say one thing and then let you go. I was just going to say, I hear you on the root level, project level, because I've rewritten this every time I go through updates of my book, because I know it, people get stuck because, so now I try to be consistent with project level, but I will do the tree. I'll visually show the tree of this is what it needs to look like. And it gets harder as the project size grows, but especially early on, for a static directory, like project level, easy to say, but I need to be and it should look exactly like that. The tree command works, right? Because I get it that they're I'm in an app, where they put things outside of settings, because maybe they didn't put the period when they did start projects, so they have another directory. And hey, Will, the official polls tutorial does it differently than you do it. What's up with that? And it's sort of well, wind me up with my thoughts. But, I should do a talk on things that are different and half matter, half don't matter. Let me just tell you.
Yeah, that's tricky as well, because when you say do it like this, and they're like, we must always do it like this forever. A lot of the time it's I need to tell you about the nuance. I need to hint at it at least and be there are other ways, but we're doing it like this for reasons. And then you end up having something that's really, really long. So it's so tricky.
Right. Someone asks you a simple question and you're how deep do I go here? Because what do you need to know to go to the next spot without... Yeah. Misrepresenting something, but sort of being focus here, don't focus there.
And how much of it should really be in the content? So you write books and books are long. And if you try and solve everybody's problems, they would be really, really, really long. And probably would also bore a few people because it would have a whole lot of details that they don't know. So it's where's the sweet spot of how much information to put in the main thing and how much to and how do you support people with the rest of it? And that's tough to do with content. That's another reason why I quite like teaching people in a human way. It's you need good content. You need freaking good content, because otherwise everybody has problems and you have to help them all, and it sucks and it's painful. but there's always these weird little rabbit holes and subquests that people need to go on, and if you can just be there to be oh, cool, you actually need this other resource. Let me just help you specifically with the thing that you need. Then that's pretty, pretty powerful.
Yeah, it's hard to scale that. I mean, it's amazing. I'm not surprised that there's demand for someone who's knowledgeable and a good teacher to do this. It's sort of, when I've thought about this, it's the 1% of teaching time, no problem. It's the other 99%, right, of finding people, updating stuff, right? I imagine that's the same case, right? You're I want to focus on this one thing, but
there's all this extra.
all the other cruft, and figuring out, okay, it works with 5 people. Does it work with 20? What's the sweet spot of that? Oh, yeah, I mean, I imagine so you're still iterating on that, right? I mean, it's sort of like the three of us. If somebody was volunteer or here's money, just parachute us into a situation, be let's just fire off answers, but it's not that simple. Yeah, assuming we even know the answers, too. Sometimes it's like, well, watch me stumble around.
yeah. So, yeah, sometimes there are a lot of left field questions, but I think that's okay as well. Tech changes all the time, and sometimes people will ask about a technology or technique, I'm like, I don't actually know. And that's cool as well, because then I can go and find out about the thing and see if it is relevant and make some suggestions about it. But I think the other thing about building an education provider organization is there's all this extra stuff that you need to do, that you were alluding to, what is the system, what is the product, how do you market this thing? My primary skill sets are software development and teaching. Those are the things that I'm really good at. And I'm okay, marketing.
Well, you have an email newsletter now. I get it, right? Do the plug. How can, aside from podcasts, where should people go to be informed?
So I do email people. But I try not to be, it's so tricky as well, because I don't want to be spammy, and I don't want to always say, buy my stuff. And I hope that the people that are listening to me at the moment are forgiving the spamminess, because I'm sure I've annoyed some people. I'm pretty certain.
I don't buy that. Sorry. Like Eric Matters was said this the other a while back as well. He's like, oh, I feel embarrassed to post my stuff. He's like, no, Eric, we want to know about your stuff. And the same with you, Shinny. We want to know what you're up to. It's, you know, people who don't like it, they can just filter that. They can just turn away.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's true. I could just use like a specific hashtag and be like, if you don't ever want to buy my courses, just filter that out and then you're good. But yeah, like whenever I have a new thing, I post on like Mastodon and Twitter and LinkedIn at the moment. And I think I should probably do Blue Sky as well. People have been telling me that I should be there. So more social media stuff. Automations help, because otherwise I would drown in social media.
Yeah, I should set some up. I guess Zapier, right? Like
Zapier's a thing. I've been using Buffer, and that's quite nice.
It's, Buffer?
Yeah, Buffer.
Oh, I don't know that.
Yeah. So it just lets you schedule stuff for multiple channels. So I found it very, very helpful. Yeah.
Huh. There you go. I learned something.
Okay. So I want to butt back in with a slightly separate question. Then we should swing back to you to the second thing that's on your agenda, and then we'll cut back. I know we'll absolutely cut back to the education topics, but just while I've got you on this very narrow topic of Django front end, is there anything given? So people have always been like, oh, can we integrate with this framework or that framework or that? And Django's always resisted that because it's a more, it doesn't want to tie itself to React, yeah, for instance. But then the Alpine and HTMX type things, they're very simple in their, you know, yeah, it's just a script tag and whatnot. But from your current work, from your workshops, from what you're seeing, is there something that Django could be doing to that you think for the static, that static file story that you're like, do you know what, if we had that, that would be a big improvement?
Yeah, I think like sometimes you need to install node modules and they should go somewhere. So like with Tailwind, I know that there are some Django Tailwind things that exist that you can just install and use. I was showing people how to sort of do it by hand and by scratch. So, mm-hmm, so like how do you use the Tailwind CLI in the context of a Django app, and how do you configure your stuff? But it's like, it feels a bit messy. So I think that's the thing. And just like, I don't know, even if you wanted to use something not Tailwind, like if you wanted to use Bootstrap or FontAwesome or anything, you need to like npm install it and it goes into your node modules, and then you need to like know to move it to your static files in a certain way. And yeah, so if there was like a solution for that, it would be cool. I think that's the main thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
But that's sort of a canonical problem, is you're like, I want to use this tool, but I don't want to do a course on this tool. But installing, yeah, this tool sort of requires a whole course, and you have to be like, just do it this way. It works. Yeah. I don't want to answer questions on it because I want to focus on something else. But then again, someone's brain is kind of, yeah, that's why, like, I still remember in graduate school, I had a professor for accounting of all classes, and people would throw all these questions at him. And he was great because he answered every question, but he would be like, as an aside. So he would just sort of say like, okay, this is like what you need to know, and this is, I'm going to answer it. And that was so helpful, because sometimes, you know, sometimes if you're overwhelmed, you're like, I just, like, I'm going to check out right now. And,
oh, yeah.
And so that was, oh, like, yeah, with people coming with different, like in that case, you had people who were totally new to accounting, and then you had people who've been doing it professionally for years. So I thought that was a really elegant way of not saying no, but just making very clear, like, this is the path we're on. And this is not, so people could sort of self-choose how much they want to process what you say.
This episode is brought to you by Buttondown. That's buttondown.com, email software for developers like you. There are hundreds of email marketing software services out there, and they all pretty much offer the same thing. Collect and clean addresses, send out broadcasts or drip campaigns, get analytics so you can see what's resonating and what's not. Buttondown is designed to hook into the tools that you already care about. Everything from static site generators like Jekyll or Hugo to payment platforms like Stripe and Memberful. You can hook your site up to Buttondown with just a form element or a simple REST call. Write emails in Markdown and then get on with the actual work you're supposed to do. New customers can save 50% off their first year with Buttondown using the coupon code Django. And if you email support, they'll white glove migrate your existing subscribers and archives for free.
Oh, that's really nice. Yeah, I think like maintaining a good signal to noise ratio is part of that, and just being like, okay, relevant, not relevant, or relevant and nice. And then the other thing I think is just giving students a bit of agency, and that's quite a big deal. So like with my workshops, I found that one way to keep people, I don't, like generally speaking, if you want to keep a person motivated, you want to give them some agency and give them some choice in what they're doing. And so if the workshop is like, do this, then like some people will just like start going through the motions or check out. But if you're like, cool, do these things, and then if you want to, here's a side quest, and it's cool for these reasons, and you can do it if you feel like it, or you can move on, or you can do it later. And just littering the thing with side quests has been really nice. Like, most people do most of the side quests, but it does give that distinction, and like people have commented that they really enjoy the fact that they get to do these things. So that's been quite fun. Yeah.
I love that the phrase side quest. Yeah. I feel like I've seen it in mass culture more and more now, like, because it is such a great way to, yeah, like the extra things that if you're so inclined.
Yeah.
yeah. Since, you know, React writing code for you, how do you talk? I want to ask about AI and LLMs, but before that, how do you approach text editors? Because, you know, there's everything from like kind of do it all for you, and then there's, you know, super basic, like, all right, so I guess I'll ask a two-part. What do you see people using, and what do you recommend to them? Because that is a very wide spectrum that's out there.
So a lot of the time, VS Code, like VS Code is very, very popular. And one of the things that I like about VS Code is the fact that it uses, like you can use it for whatever language you want. Which is nice. It's not like glued to one thing, because I do switch languages sometimes, and it's nice to not have to just like switch to a different tool completely. So that's that. I kind of like things that are not super opinionated. I don't like things that make assumptions for me and write the code for me too much, because I'm like, what's actually happening back there? Like it's nicer to understand. And then I suppose the other question is around LLMs in these things, which is, do you want to go down that rabbit hole? It's a deep one.
I would love to if you're up for it. Yeah.
Yeah. So personally, I haven't used a lot of different ones for writing code. Because I'm on VS Code, I've used Copilot a lot, but I often find it disruptive and then end up turning it off. So I find like with code that is quite obvious, then like it makes good suggestions and speeds me up. But a lot of the time, if I'm doing something novel, then it gives me very weird and distracting suggestions, and then I turn it off. I think in our last discussion, the last one we had, Carlton, you said using Copilot is like pair programming with the drunk person.
Yeah.
I think that's a Carlton quote.
Yeah, no, I don't remember saying it, but I remember. That sounds like sort of thing I would have said. Right?
That should be on their website. That's the tagline.
Yeah, like it really is.
That thing you just said about when you're thinking about something difficult and you're trying to think through the problem, and then all of a sudden it's put these three lines of junk there, and you're like, no, go away with the three lines of junk. I'm trying to think now, and it's knowing when to just switch that thing off.
Yeah, switching it off is important. And like, I've even found, I don't know, like let's say you want to write some Django models quickly for a fairly well-known problem. So the ticketing system I'm using is not appropriate and I would like a different one. So I'm like, cool, maybe I should make one. And so I was like, hey, like make me some models for a ticketing system. And it was just like scope creep. All of the scope creep. It's like it won't necessarily go for the simplest version of what you want. It'll go for like the fanciest, most complicated thing. Often, like if I use like an LLM chat situation to generate code, if I'm like, I'm not actually sure how to do this, show me how to do this, then it'll often come up with something really complicated and weird, and then I'll say like, okay, simplify it. And then it'll be something I'm like, okay, that actually looks like it'll work. So yeah, you got to do things with like a major spoonful of salt. In my experience so far, like every now and again, I try again, and then I get tired of it and back out.
It's still learning how to do its thing, right? And the tool developers are still learning how to integrate that.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I mean, it's definitely like upward trending. It's definitely getting better.
I think I say I. I think I mentioned this publicly. So I've just joined JetBrains, the developer advocate who makes PyCharm and some other text editors. So I'm very deep, or getting deeper into this world. And like this morning I was going through, there's some new features coming out. And it's definitely a thing. I think it's just interesting to see where the boundaries are. Because to me, there's a newcomer can just write a couple lines of code and have a, you know, ticketing Django website, but they have no idea what it does. And, you know, it's not 100% how any of us would do it. And so I feel like in a way that makes it harder to learn because it's so easy to get slop given to you.
Yeah.
Not that I want to be like, you have to do it manual for everything, but there's just the total lack of curation out there. At the same time, for the last year or two, I think spurred a lot by Jeff Triplett and some other people, like I use it all the time as a drunken coding partner where I have context and I'm like, oh, you know, I want ideas basically. Like, how would you do this thing? And I've learned how to be, you know, how to ask it to like improve things or remove stuff. So I find it really helpful for idea generation. But I, you know, to go the next step, which some code editors already do, of just like write the prompt and it does all the code for you. It seems very hard for me in a Django context for that to work. Like maybe for tests, it could work. For front end, I think it works actually pretty well because you can see it. But, you know, something around billing or something else, you know, where you kind of really want to A, have it be correct, and B, know what's going on. It's almost like, you know, you want a pistol and you're given a bazooka.
Definitely.
But it's definitely the thing. And then I'll just last stream of consciousness thought. I also it's very interesting to me, the context in which it can be used. And by that I mean a lot of people at work are not allowed to use a public facing LLM, right? So some people are like no LLM. Some people are like give everything to ChatGPT or Claude or whomever. And then these local models like Llama from Facebook and stuff. You know, so there are text editors that can, and ways you can work with that, right? Like it's a little clunky now, but that's going to be pretty smooth very soon if it isn't already. So it seems like there are these three stages of how you use it, how much public, and then the whole education piece around how should you use it. So for anyone who asks me, I'm like, do not ask it to just like do some huge mega task. Like ask it very specific questions and treat it as a drunken coding partner. Anyway, so that's everything I have to say on that topic. I'm curious what you two think.
Well, just to pick up that last bit, and I'm going to point it at you, Sheen. Like, it's that learning thing that worries me. So I'm quite an experienced old hand now. I'm, you know, my fingers creak a bit. So to have some fast autocomplete, that's super. But
you're a month away from a neck beard.
Yeah, exactly. That's how old exactly. You know, but so for me, it's great, and it's foibles I can work around, and I can use it when I want to and not. I worry basically about a junior picking up an LLM, and how are they going to get the sort of deeper understanding that you need to really solve the harder problems?
Yeah, I get you. That is a huge, huge deal. A lot of people use it as a crutch when they're starting to learn to code, and then they don't learn the main lessons. And I think, like, I've been trying to figure out how to best explain, like, why it's wrong to rely on an LLM too much while you're learning. And like, let's say you're learning a language, like Italian. And when you start learning this language, it's not like you'll start off by translating one word and then translating like small groups of words. And, you know, LLMs can do that better than you. But your goal isn't to be a translation service. Your goal is to be able to have conversations and do like bigger things. And like people, when they're learning to code, when they start learning to code, they act as a translation service because you're like, give them these little tiny problems to solve, and then they solve them and you're like, well done you. But they often come to the conclusion that that is what coding is, and look, these LLMs can do it better than me. Yeah. And honestly, like, becoming code literate is the easiest part of becoming a software developer. The hard part happens later when you take what you've learned, you take your words and your sentences and you combine them into something much bigger and much more complicated with other people. And that's like, if you don't nail these foundational skills, you just don't get that. And like the other aspect of it is like, cool, we can write prompts to write code that works in certain situations. That's great. And we can write prompts in English. English is a blunt instrument compared to code. It's like the most precise way you can describe what a machine should do is in the code. It's not in English. And there are many problems that you can describe, many algorithms you can describe in English, and then it can spit out the code, and that's great. But like, there are many that you can't. And like, if English was as precise as we would like it to be, lawyers wouldn't be a thing, you know.
But also, quite often, even as good as a spec as you write, you don't really know what the algorithm is until you write it. And then you've got, that's your proof, right? The implementation is the proof. Like,
That is,
And it's going to vary because it's non-deterministic. Like, that's the other piece. Yeah. So it's unreliable and it's different all the time. And the wild thing is, everything's wild to me today. Another, like, I've had a chance to actually talk to a bunch of AI startups recently, and, you know, any AI startup is like, I'm going to, take Krednoth and like send prompts to ChatGPT and boom, I'm an AI startup. That's kinda, I'm not even exaggerating. That's like, if you actually talk to these people at like a bar, that's what they're doing. And they're daisy chaining all these prompts together that like kinda sorta work. So then it's wildly loosey goosey versus, you know, again, it's English, it's not code. And then they're also tied to the specific model. So you have
a version of that model as well.
Someone down the hall from me who's at a very well-funded healthcare startup with millions of dollars, you know, that they've got certain commands that work with like, you know, 3.1, which is different than 3.3. And you just don't want to like touch any of it because as soon as you do, it's like, oof.
And spell something different, or just like swap the sentences around in some way. And
but that's the thing. Like, you know, we as developers, if you talk to, like, I just recently went to this startup thing here in Boston, and there was, you know, there's a lot of people with money who aren't technical, and then a few technical people. And you talk to the non-technical people, and they're amazing evangelists for what all this can do, right? But like, practically speaking, everyone has a CRUD and auth something that is just sending English daisy chain prompts to ChatGPT, and that gets them 5 to 10 million in funding. And they're like, this is all, oh my God, so fragile and yikes.
And a lot of that stuff is often something that you could do in regular code. But anyway, Colton?
Yes. Well, but yes. And it's not the same answer. So if like I'm, you know, it's this insurance company or whatever, or cardiologists, you know, like all the big hospitals here, they're using it. I remember one of them was bragging to me about, he's at MGH, Mass General Hospital, which is one of the top hospitals in the world. And he's like, yeah, we have our internal LLM for da da. And I was like, well, how do you handle the fact that it gives you different results for the same prompt, like guaranteed? And he was like, huh, I don't know. I got to ask our developers. I'm like, well, I'm curious what they say too.
I hadn't heard that analogy, Will, of CRUD North Plus LLMs, because that
I just came up
with
it. No,
but that's the startup model now. But
that is what it is.
If you go back half a dozen years, or say 10 years, the startup model was CRUD North plus Twilio. It's exactly the same, right? It was like, we're going to wrap something around Twilio, and there we are. And now it's like, we're going to wrap something around, ChatGPT. There was an analogy.
To Sheena's point, often you don't need it for it, is the thing. Like, sometimes you do, but a lot of it you could have done.
But you get more funding if you make your product a little bit more brittle. Yeah.
There was an
it's weird.
You talked about fundamentals, about like, you know, so someone learning with an LLM instead of doing the hard time on the editor. There's a similar point that gets made about web frameworks. The people begin they begin by learning the web framework, and they never really learn about HTML and CSS and JavaScript, and so they come to a sort of more vanilla solution, like, is that even possible? And they don't know, you know, there's lots that they just don't know. But if you're a youngster starting out and you need a job, you do the boot camp, you learn the framework, you apply for the job, you get the job, and maybe you never have that time. So if I'm a youngster coming through now, I work with the LLM, I get the code written, it may not be perfect, but that's the, you know, the dull hand of economic determinism doesn't give me time to sit down and say, no, I'm going to spend 10 years writing it.
Yeah. How do we... Mastering this.
How do we...
Yeah, it's hard. How do we juggle that? How do we deal with that? It's tough because you do need results. I think you can do a lot of good in not that much time. Like if you just like focus on learning the fundamentals of a language, it doesn't really take that long to learn what a variable is, what a return statement is, what a loop is. And people are skipping over that level of fundamentals,
right,
which is a problem. That's like a big, big problem. But then when it comes to frameworks, it's tough in a lot of ways. So I think certain frameworks are good teachers. So Django, for example, I think it's a good teacher. I learned Python by learning Django, and I learned a lot about web development by learning Django. And learning different frameworks and like even building stuff from like the ground up in different ways has been made a lot easier because of what I've learned in Django. So that's cool. A framework can be like also a mental framework that you can hang new knowledge onto, and that's very helpful. So frameworks that are like really explicit about how they work is good. Some frameworks are less explicit. Some frameworks you need to put your code in the right places, and then the magic happens, and voila, you have a thing, but you're not really sure how it happened. You're just following the rules of this framework.
Yeah, it's the magic and batteries, yeah. Pendulum is how I think about it.
Yeah, yeah. So I think explicit is better than implicit. There's that zen. But then I think there's also, like, if somebody learns a framework and gets into their first job and is able to do certain things and not others because they're missing those foundations. Like, if you don't have your foundational skills, you can only code to a certain level. There's a certain level of problem that you can work on and some that are just, like, outside of your reach until you learn certain things. And those certain things aren't always obvious to the person who needs the skills. Like, there are unknown unknowns. And for the organizations that hire the juniors as well, they're not necessarily set up to seek out those unknown unknowns and plug those knowledge gaps. And so sometimes a person will be writing code that makes them look like, I don't know, irresponsible or lazy in different ways. But it's like, oh, you actually just don't understand this one concept. That's why your code's like so repetitive, because you're not really that sure about how functions work. And so it's easy to almost like see a person's like nasty code, and that's like a symptom of a problem, and you like fall into the trap of like attributing that symptom to like a personality trait sometimes, instead of like, oh, they're just missing some skills,
a moral failing, right?
yeah it's like, why are you writing such repetitive code? Just put it in a function, bruh. Like, just do it. Why not? and then they can't.
Yeah
but I think that's a good example where you can do this in some text editors, but to like to take code you've written and then as an exercise to throw it to an LLM and say, make this better, because it might well make it better, right? It might not, but like, especially as you're learning, I think there is that, like, it's like, what is that balance between your own stuff and the LLM? And I think the LLM's great once you've given it a good college try. That's what I use it for, you know, but it's super helpful for that, because that's where it's really strong. Like, testing, it's super strong. I think refactoring, it actually can be strong. It can also just be wildly hallucinating. But you know, if that, it'd be interesting. It's almost, you almost want, that could be a cool service. Like, every Git commit, run it through just a refactor LLM, and then
that's cool, actually.
Like, that, you know, because like I use, you know, I don't know, like you, like I use pre-commit on my real projects, which is awesome. And a lot of times I'm just sort of like, yeah, just fix it and move on. You know, I'm not like truly like, you know, because it's like I added a space, a lot of it's HTML or white space stuff. But that would be an interesting idea for some sort of like gut check with your drunk programming friend, because if you don't, I don't know. Yeah, I'm just thinking about that. But that's one I think an LLM would be really good for, is to spot you could do this function differently.
I think that can be cool. I haven't actually tried that, but that is interesting. I think people often use it for like, explain this code to me, which I think is useful. Because if it can go line by line and make it clear, then that is very, very handy. And then what else do they do? Explain this error message to me. That's another really good one.
Error messages.
Yeah. Well,
and I think people don't realize, sorry, Carlton, I know you want to say it. Like, go ahead.
Well, I was going to just put another example there, but is that, go on, you go.
Well, sorry, I'll just continue on this point then. I was just going to say, you know, if you see that the LLM is wrong on something, if you say, are you sure, or is that, you know, incorrect, those like, oh, I'm sorry. And then a lot of times that second pass, it will get it a lot more right. So the thing is, it doesn't know. I mean, so I see this all the time. So like, as I'm trying to, I'm still very novice, but like using it, you know, it's like, give me lots of ideas and I'll spit something out. I'm like, oh, that's not quite right. If you dial it in, and then the thing is, it also remembers, it has a memory of your interactions. So for example, ChatGPT, like I used it I used it to help building out learnjango.com. So now if I ask an unrelated Django question, it automatically gives responses kind of related to that project just because I've asked previous questions about it. So again, sometimes that's quite helpful. And then sometimes that's wildly unhelpful. Yeah, I probably just need to say like
anchored on the wrong thing.
don't just ignore it again. So yeah, a brave new world. But I feel like eventually these things will be sorted out. Like we're all driving a manual car and soon it'll be a little more automatic, I think. Carlton,
well,
go ahead.
Just going to throw in the example there. There's if you give it some test cases and say, write me some .dot or draft some .dot, you know, lots of projects don't have great docs. And you can say, give me some usage docs for this. And it'll come up with stuff that's readable and accessible. And you think, okay, well, that was
better than nothing.
Yeah, that was better than the no docs that are currently there. So there.
Yeah, or switching, you know, switching from Django test to PyTest. So Justin Duke, who's sponsoring this episode with Button Down, he has a blog post we'll link to. He used Cursor for this and just said, which is an AI powered, it's like VS Code with marketing and LLMs a little more. I'm sorry, that's probably a disservice to it, but it's very hot right now. But he just used it to port over the tests, right? And that's a great use case of A testing as sort of, but especially if it's a known thing and to manually switch it over from PyTest or vice versa would really take a while. That'd be hard even for a knowledgeable person to do.
I think that's cool, like using it as a translation service. Like if you know one language and you want to know another language, you can say like, do this in Rust. And then you can look at it and be like,
tests,
oh, is that how?
do the tests pass or not, right? That's the key thing is that, and it doesn't hurt you to have tests that do or don't work. I think that's the key thing too, unlike fiddling with your, you know, authentication or something.
So back to education slightly. So LLMs are obviously massive and hot and the new thing and all the money's going into them. And are they're pushing their way into ed tech, I take it, quite rapidly. Is that the state of the art there? Is that the exciting thing happening? What's your view on where we're at?
It's happening, but there's a lot of hype and a lot of teachers who aren't adopting these tools for lots of different reasons. And I think there are issues. So the one was like that thing I mentioned earlier about students having unknown unknowns. Like sometimes they're really confident in their unknown unknowns or like in how they think the world is. Like that guy I mentioned earlier with the React. It's like he wouldn't think to ask an LLM these questions. But sometimes it takes a human where he's like, I want to show you, human, this thing that I like. They're unlikely to have that conversation with a machine. They'll ask the questions that are focused on their known unknowns or the rabbit holes that they want to go down, which aren't always a human is a better guide in these cases. And I think the other thing that LLMs are supposedly good for is like, okay, the teacher can like input some stuff and then it can solve the teacher's problems for this student or for this class, but it doesn't necessarily go that first mile where it's like, okay, what stuff does the teacher fill in? Like everything. They need to give like so much context before they get an answer out a lot of the time. And unless you've got like a new class of students and you're doing something from scratch where the prompting is like pretty straightforward, if you're doing something for, like, I've got this problem with this existing student, and here are their marks, and here is what they've done so far, and these are, like, this, like, I've spoken to their mom, and, you know, like, entering all of that is really hard. So, like, that first mile is tough. Yeah, but there are, like, a lot of ways that it can be useful. I mean, there is stuff around content generation, creating coursework and whatnot. And that's, like, you got to be careful. You got to be very careful.
Yeah, right.
So, like, yeah. Especially if you're talking about something that's either, like, new and novel. So if you're writing a course for, like, some kind of new software thing, then it's going to just make stuff up because it doesn't know. For something that's, like, you know, robust and well-used and whatnot, it'll make stuff up less. But if something's confusing, like Git, for example, then it'll make up weird stuff. So, like, I use LLMs when I'm making my workshops and stuff, because sometimes I'm just like, how do I explain this weird thing? Like, give me a metaphor to explain this. Give me a story to explain this. Explain why it's important. And then I can take that and adapt it quite a lot. And when I was making the Git course, I asked it a bunch of questions. I'm like, whoa, that's actually, like, really misleading, what you're saying there, Git. So, yeah, there's challenges there. I think other things, like marking projects, assessments, I think that's also, like, assessing a person's skills, like, that's not a solved problem, even if you're having, like, humans do it. And it's very easy to, yeah, it's very easy to just, like, either focus on the wrong things or give people bad advice. So, yeah, like, using an LLM to review student code sometimes gives them, like, really misleading advice.
Well, which they probably wrote with an LLM, right?
So that's... It's possible, yeah. But even if they didn't, it's, like, just to get it, like, strict enough but not too strict is really hard. So you need to, like, make sure that you're teaching them the lessons but also not giving them, like, random nonsense to do. So, for example, I was trying to get... I was trying to get one of the, like, GPT models to review code at one point, and I was trying to be like, just be a little stricter, not that loosey-goosey. And then eventually I was at a point where I was like, every single unit test needs a full doc string. I'm like, that's, like, weird advice to give to somebody who's learning how to code, because they often do very strange things with doc strings and comments. So that's tricky. I do think that there's a lot of good stuff around just, like, self-assessment. So if you have low-stakes assessments for students where they can sort of get a view of their own skills and where they're at, then that's super, super powerful if the student is, like, plugged into it and not just trying to, like, tick the boxes and move forward. Like, a lot of people have been trained to tick boxes. But if somebody's, like, genuinely interested in the feedback that they're getting, that they're, like, they've been asked this question, they don't know the answer, here's the answer, then that's... Yeah, that can be very, very powerful. I don't think I've seen a lot of that, but it is a good thing.
I keep getting the impression that, like, it's clear to me that you believe that the human element in teaching is all important. And what's interesting, though, is the difficulty of making a single human go very far. Humans aren't very spreadable, yeah. Right? We're quite...
Yeah, it's a real problem.
Contained. So it doesn't sound as if you think there's a holy grail for that available change it with the technological change will suddenly make education that much more accessible.
I think it's like an 80-20 thing. I think that you can do a lot with good tools and good content. But I do think, like, just from my experience with dealing with students, I've come across a few people that I'm like, I have no idea how I would have, like, detected this without, I don't know, making the students maybe jump through a lot of hoops or having some, like, weird way to interrogate them. Because sometimes it's just a matter of, like, spending time with the student while they're doing a thing, and then you notice that they did something weird or they said something weird, and you're just like, let's just dig in your brain a little bit and see what that was about.
Yeah, right.
And that's not, like, it's not it's not something you can automate, but... As far as I've seen, anyway, like, I'm sure things will get better, but I don't know how to automate that. But what I have noticed, so, like, my kind of way of teaching people is, I teach adults, I don't teach kids, because kids are, like, they come with all sorts of different challenges, which I'm not that experienced in. I like them, but the way I teach is more about just empowering the individual to almost teach themselves as much as possible. So that means like very good content, very like clear content, very like steps that have been thought out very carefully. Like the content needs to be built in a way that like really takes takes like learning mechanisms into account. So it's like, okay, spaced repetition and recall, and how can we get them to build mental frameworks and blah, blah, blah. So you make like damn fine content, set them up for success as much as you can. And then when somebody struggles, you help them. And a lot of people will like, a lot of people won't struggle, and that's great. And it's like, freaking go you, that's fantastic. You didn't need the human. Maybe like, LLMs can make that a bit better. So like fewer people will need the human, but I think there'll still be like some folks who either get left behind or derailed because of weirdness.
Yeah. And my experience of teaching is that if you miss that building block, then that's when it's really important that someone's there to rescue them at that time, because otherwise they're lost forever. And it was that one block.
And there's also a lot in teaching around like a person's emotional journey to some extent. So like if you're teaching somebody something hard, if a person is learning software, like it can be really, really frustrating in the beginning because they'll like, they'll forget to indent something and then everything's wrong. Or they're getting an error message because they forgot the colon and they don't know about where the colons should be. Or, you know, when you make those like single character mistakes and then you like bump your head on it for hours. And people like often they'll remember the emotional experience instead of like the end of things. So if they bump their head on a concept for like hours and hours and hours and then they won, and then they start bumping their head on the next concept for hours and then they win, they'll remember like this sucked, it was hard. You know, but sometimes it takes a teacher to be like, hey, you know that thing that you were struggling with last week? You're kind of nailing it now.
Yeah, right.
'Cause people don't always notice that in themselves. Like the cheerleading aspect is actually pretty big.
My Thai teacher is always like, no, don't look in front. Don't look at what you don't know or can't do. Look how far you've come.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a big deal.
So this is going back 10 minutes. But I wanted to add something to what you were saying about like the example of a teacher not using an LLM. And I think one of the interesting things about LLMs now is preloading context. So I'm sure the three of us in a weekend, we could build CRUD plus auth that loaded in the records, the attendance sheet. So you see student name, parents, like you can load in this information. That makes it so that when you do ask prompts, it is kind of custom to you. So I do think I suspect that type of thing is where most of the efficiency gains are going to be unlocked, where it's not anything that creative. It's just like an existing thing, sandbox it, and it just saves time. And it lets someone, a teacher with 200 students or, whatever ungodly level, okay, it's never going to replace one-on-one, but they can do something in a way that they couldn't before. And a lot of stuff in the same way code, these LLMs can design code and then we review it. I mean, if you look at so many businesses now, it's humans signing off on something, right? I mean, it helps in medical for various reasons with licenses and stuff, but radiologists, like many of them are using stuff that just like speeds it up, right? And so that to me, cardiologists too, right? Like, I mean, it's like, okay, patient has boom, 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 boom. If it helps them be faster or even think of new things, like they're using it at some of the hospitals here, just like primary care, because turns out LLMs, I think in the study I saw, are actually better than humans because we have biases. Whereas if you just like presented patient information and symptoms, it can do a really good job. Whereas we as humans, are going off other factors. So it's interesting how I think it's a great, like enhancement, like a great cane or crutch. And I think that's how it's probably going to be used, to not fully replace, but to, bicycle for the mind or something.
It makes a lot of sense. But I think it's something like, so earlier I said like assessment in education isn't quite solved, and I think that that could lead to some weirdness. So I'll give you like an actual example of a thing that I saw. Students had to complete a bunch of projects. They had X amount of projects and they needed to get them done. And so this could be visualized as like a burndown chart. So you can see their progress over time, and that's great. And they're all like interacting with each other in different ways. Some of them are helping each other, some of them are supporting each other in different ways. Great. And then there was this parallel stream of education stuff where people had to write these little tests based on basic coding charters. So like super easy coding charters from like similar to HackerRank and LeetCode and all of that. And a lot of people were like missioning ahead with their projects, but they couldn't solve the most basic charters. So it's like, you clearly don't know what a for loop means. You clearly don't know what a, like how this return statement thing works. People get confused about that all the time, like all the time. And so we had these two metrics of their performance, and depending on which one you prioritize, depends on like that. So like if the project progress is the most important thing, then you will push people to maybe help each other more on their projects, or you'll find ways to like push that a bit forward. And if the charters are the most important thing, then you'll say like, cool, let's look at your fundamentals. Do you understand this loop thing? So the projects were being prioritized and not the fundamentals. And I had a chat with one of the students, and I was like, okay, cool. Like I've dug around in your brain, and it looks like these are the things that you're struggling with. And here's how you can practice it. And do you understand? Yes. Yes. You understand how to go and practice it? Yes. Will you? No. It's like, why not? I'm like, I don't have time. It's like, why? Because I'm too busy on my schoolwork. I was like, oh, so there's a lot around just like the possibility of optimizing for the wrong metric and not knowing like the trade-offs between things. And yeah, it's very easy to get wrong. Like I've seen some very smart people like do some very strange things around optimizing for metrics.
It's that, I can't remember the name of the law now, but the, you know, as soon as it becomes a target, it gets gamed, right? It ceases to function as a measure.
Yeah, it can be a big problem. Standardized tests, oof, such a problem.
So we have to mention your DjangoCon talk, which was amazing, on, you know, education and the theory around it. And I don't know if we've got a particular question now, but I want to make sure we mention it and perhaps ask you about it a little bit.
Yeah, thanks. I'm really proud of that talk. It took some doing to just like figure out what to say, because there's so much to be said about education, and fitting it into a talk, it's like you really need to pick your battles. Yeah.
Well, one thing I love is you keep using this phrase, dig around in people's brains, which is a lovely metaphor.
I find that very important. So for me, like one of the main things I try to get teachers to understand is like, you need to understand the student. So often, like if a student doesn't understand a thing, then the teacher will try and explain it, and then they'll be like, oh, you still don't understand, I'll explain it a different way. Oh, you still don't get it, I'll explain it a different way. I've tried all my ways of explaining it. That's me tapping out. But sometimes if you just like almost try to investigate how the person is understanding it, and you say like, cool, I've got a theory that you might be understanding it like this. My theory could be right, it could be wrong. Let me try and think of some questions that you can answer that you could get right or wrong, and that'll inform me. So to be like a little bit of a scientist so you want to be a bit of a scientist and investigate the mental frameworks that people are building and how they interpret the things to work. And that makes teaching like way more stimulating, because explaining a for loop over and over again is like not the most fun, but digging around in a person's brain, that can be kind of fun, because they're all very different.
As well, it makes it like programming, right? Because we're trying to, if we're doing it right in product design, we're trying to understand our user's mental model and help them to build the correct mental model for our product via the UI or via the user experience that we offer. That sounds very similar. I mean, clearly it's, you know, it's a sibling thing, but this, you know, that there's a certain affinity between those two processes.
We are coming a little bit up on time. I want to ask you, have we not asked you anything? Are there things you want to promote that you haven't? So we're going to have links to Prelude. That's where people should go to find out about upcoming workshops and sign up for your newsletter.
We forgot,
Carlton,
right at the beginning, ages ago, Sheena had a whole second thing that we just didn't talk about at all.
It's okay. And this is such a good conversation.
Oh, is this the Guild of Educators?
Yes,
is this what we're neglecting?
I have a guild. I always wanted a guild. So the idea there is, like, I've been looking at the software training ecosystem as a whole for a while, and there are lots of, like, things that are suboptimal in many different ways, and I'm trying to figure out how to nudge things in a good direction. And one of the things that I think is really powerful is just really valuing teachers and empowering teachers. So taking the humans in the system and just, like, making them like reducing the dropout rate, because people just, like, drop out of teaching because they get frustrated for a lot of very good reasons. And so providing a support structure is a part of it. So providing information and so that's pretty cool. I've gotten a lot out of it just by talking to the members and saying, like, I've got this crazy idea, and then I can talk to them and they can poke holes in my idea or yes and it, and that's been very, very helpful. So I want to, like, take the people who teach and just, like, upregulate them and myself. So that's that. And the idea with Guild of Educators and Prelude is, like, ideally things should feed into each other in some way. So, like, I'm trying new education things with Prelude, and I'm learning lessons, and I would like to share those lessons with other teachers. And I also know that teachers, like, at some point I'll be able to hire some people, and it would be good to have those relationships already in place, so I can, like hire people who know what's up, or hire people who need teaching experience and give them a chance to learn. So that's that. And it's a completely free community, guildofeducators.org. Just, like, show up and join the Discord, and I'm going to start having events again soon. So that's that. And then things to plug. My newsletter is on my personal blog. I've got a lot of tidying up to do on the, like, marketing, identity, brand front. But yeah, if you go to my blog, then you can sign up for the newsletter, and I talk about
and what is the
there.
URL of your blog?
It is sheenaoc.com. Sheenaoc is one word. Yeah.
We'll have a link to it too.
So you'll hear about all of the things, all of the training things, all of the things I'm thinking about, and some random stuff, which is fun. And with Prelude, I've got a couple of courses coming up. So I've got one on Git coming up very, very soon. It is happening on the 24th, which is a Friday.
Okay.
So I'm gonna.
This comes out on week 23rd. So that's a pretty quick turnaround. But
okay. Well,
if there's spots, there's a day to sign up.
Well, I'm doing another modern front end dev workshop.
22nd.
Mid-February, and so folks could sign up for that if they're keen. It is super fun, and yes, I could give you a discount code. I can say Django Chat rocks with underscores.
And, yes.
Okay, right. There you are, listeners. Go.
And we'll give you a discount, which is great. I suppose there is actually, like, one more thing to mention. I know this is getting long now, but, like, so one of my things that I'm trying to do with Prelude is generate extra goodness that I can share with different people, because there are people who can afford training and there are people who can't. And, like, I am in South Africa. I am in Africa. There's a lot of people who could do with training, but there's challenges here. So I aim to, like, so I charge money for the workshops, and the goal is to make them affordable for folks in, like, the US and Europe and whatnot. And then use excess capacity and whatever excess funds I have, I can use to train folks in and around Africa. So I'm, like, still figuring out how to best distribute that. Like, I'm still experimenting around that front, but yeah, that is a fun thing that I'm working on.
No, and that's cool.
Yeah. Well, you can't solve all the problems at once, right? You got to go iterate through them.
Yeah, iterating. There's a lot right now, but it's all very exciting.
Well, good. Well, we'll have to have you back on in, I don't know, 12 months, and you can tell us how everything's been a success, hopefully.
Yeah, I hope so.
And it's so good to catch up. I think we both saw you at the Django Cons. You were doing kind of a whole little world tour of conferences, which we didn't get to ask you about, but...
That was a wild year.
really excited to see this is where you've ended up and that it's really taken off. And I'm not surprised. I mean, to have a knowledgeable, passionate educator who knows Django and web stuff is, you almost can't pay enough to that kind of person. And the fact that you're still clearly enjoying it and doing it
thanks so
is
much.
Great.
Yeah, it's a hell of a Venn diagram. Yeah.
All right, so I'll wrap it up. So we are djangochat.com, links to everything in the show notes, and we'll see everyone next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. This episode was brought to you by Button Down, the easiest way to start, send, and grow your email newsletter.